Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Rohrkraut.
And today we are celebrating spooky season very early. Normally, we dedicate some time in October to covering one of our favorite genres, horror. But in the summer, we tend to get a number of horror releases, and July is no exception. So we will be talking about A Quiet Place Day One, Maxine, and Longlegs today. Three new releases, all horror movies to varying extents, I would say. I think some of them I thought might be a little bit scarier than they ended up being, but that's okay. We'll get into those. But I think just to start out, horror as a genre, for any listeners who might be new, what do you think about it? Is it one of your favorites? I know the answer to this, but it'll be helpful for people to know, I think, as we get into this conversation.
I absolutely love horror. It is, I think, easily my favorite genre. There's so much history to it dating back almost 100 years. And there are so many different subgenres and tropes and things that people can, you know, whether you like one thing or not, pick up on and follow throughout the years, because we get dozens, if not more, horror movies a year, for better or worse. And I think these three that we'll talk about today are very different. And I think that's exciting for audiences. I've been anticipating, I guess, all of these all year. We had teasers for Longlegs in January, 6 months ago, building up to this incredible release. And as of release, it is out today. So I recommend everyone go see all three of these. Maxine, we know, is part of Ty West's trilogy. We've had X, we've had Pearl, and now Maxine, the closer. So we'll talk about that. And then A Quiet Place, also the third in its potential series. I'm sure we will have more. We've had A Quiet Place and A Quiet Place Part 2, both directed by John Krasinski. And this is a prequel. So I think all three of them in some ways will be enticing to viewers. And I don't necessarily think, in terms of what I like, that I was as scared as I wanted to be in any of them. But I do think that it's exciting for the genre, and we have more coming. We have Cuckoo that I'm really excited about, The Substance from Cannes that had crazy reviews. So we have so much more coming, and I'm excited that the genre is still very much alive. How do you feel about it?
I mean, similarly to you, horror is one of my favorite genres. I grew up watching horror movies, the classics, when I was way too young. And they were, I think, the first movies really that made me feel like an adult, or that gave me, you know, that exciting sensation that you can only really hope for when you watch movies, which is that they make you feel really alive and on edge and like you're watching something you're not supposed to be. I think that's a really fun thing with horror, and it really is the best genre historically for filmmakers to get to really experiment. And I think that that makes it a really exciting playground for new directors, for directors in different genres to experiment. And because horror directors love the genre so much, we do come across a lot of different references and tropes that I think we'll talk through at least for Maxine and Longlegs today as things that either enrich the experience or dampen the experience. So another thing to know with all three of these, we won't be spoiling these movies. So if you haven't seen them yet, we won't reveal how they wrap up or anything like that. We'll keep the conversation, I think, nice and loose, but keep it spoiler free.
And with horror, there are these understated queer elements that I think a lot of viewers have picked up on over time. And that's why the genre has such a big following, too, is that a lot of these turn into cult classics for one reason or another. But I think that adds into characteristics of the villains or monsters or this underlying sense of not belonging. And that allows you to relate to either the characters or the villains in different ways. And that's really another reason why I like the genre and why it's so exciting.
I think so too. So let's get started with A Quiet Place Day One. Description here: a woman named Sam finds herself trapped in New York City during the early stages of an invasion by alien creatures with ultra-sensitive hearing. This was directed by Michael Sarnowski and stars Lupita Nyong'o, Joseph Quinn, Alex Wolff, Jaimin Hunsu, and Schnitzel the Cat, the most important little actor. I mean, he was my favorite part of the movie, so we'll get into that too. But first, how do you feel about these movies? And did you like A Quiet Place Day One as a prequel?
I generally really like this entire trilogy as it stands right now. Opening with A Quiet Place, it was a different kind of horror where it really relied on sound and played into a different kind of terror that I don't think I'd seen in a while. And then with the sequel, I think it lived up to that original film. So I was really happy with that, despite having a big twisted conclusion and going on this new journey in two with Emily Blunt's character. So with three being a prequel, also I was worried, and also that John Krasinski wasn't directing. And at the time, we didn't know who was going to step in. And so we now know it's Michael Sarnowski, who directed Pig, which we both liked. Also with Nicolas Cage, another connection to today. But I really enjoyed this movie. I think it lives up to everything that made us really get into that world. There's suspense, there's thrill, there's terror, there are new characters. Some that I like, some maybe that I didn't like. And it's still this world-building narrative that I think at first I didn't like as much, but it kind of leads into there being another film and this just being part of their journey, even though we're going back almost 2 years, I think. So if you liked one and two, this is very similar, and I would still recommend seeing this one. How did you feel about this versus the first two?
I think that the first one, when it came out, it was a really nice surprise. It was a completely new concept. And I also thought that just the way that it used sound and having Millicent Simmons as this deaf actress and how she interpreted the world of the film and how the film played with that, I thought was really interesting and just, again, a unique concept. It was never one of my favorite horror movies, so I tend to not really care as much for the, I would say, sci-fi horror or alien type of horror. I love the film Alien, one of my favorites, but as a subgenre, this isn't really the one that gets under my skin compared to others. The second movie I thought was fine. Going into day one, I thought, is this a movie we really need? Like, do I really care about a prequel to the Quiet Place movies? Maybe not. Will I see it anyway? Yes, because I like Michael Sarnowski. I liked Pig. And I like these actors. I was excited to see Lupita Nyong'o again. And that cat on the poster, as a cat person, I was just excited to see it. But I think with the release, there wasn't a lot of hype around it, and I wasn't really sure what that meant. I was kind of reading into that a little bit and did worry that it might be bad, but I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed this. I thought it was much better, I think, than I anticipated from a prequel to A Quiet Place. I found it to be like a really human, emotional story, and when it first starts and we're at this hospice, I thought, oh no, this is just going to be one of those tug at your heartstrings, sort of like saccharine or cheesy movies. And it wasn't for me. I did cry multiple times during the film, but it felt just like a really unique way, I think, to couch this prequel, right? And to think about death and dying and what your life means and what time really means at the end of the world. I love that it was set in New York. I think it makes sense why New York is always a setting in these sorts of disaster movies, or, you know, it's always ground zero, you feel like, to everything in films like this. And I thought that it played with the setting pretty effectively. And as everyone's getting to South Seaport to get on these ferries because the creatures can't swim, and Sam and Eric, this lawyer that she meets, they're traveling uptown. They need to get to Harlem because she is hell-bent on getting pizza, which I also thought was just such an amazing detail. It's like, you know, you're dying. What do you want actually at the end of the world? You want a good final meal. And she wanted to go to this pizza place that was really nostalgic for her and was really important to her. And I don't know. I thought that was, it's a really beautiful detail. And I liked seeing them travel uptown, really trying to make it through this final quest to get their pizza, which was, it sounds so silly talking about it, but I think it is kind of beautiful in the context of the movie.
When she was like, the world's ending, I don't care, we're getting pizza. I was so worried because it sounds really hokey. And initially, which is not shared in any of the trailers or posters, we learn that Lupita Nyong'o's character, Sam, has cancer and that she's dying. And throughout the film, she's like, they gave me a year, they gave me 6 months, I'm still here. So I think once I learned that, yeah, my heart just immediately broke. I sobbed in this movie. I read my review from part two, and I was apparently emotional, but I don't think as much as I was here, because the story just totally wrecks you. And there was one of the most romantic scenes I've ever seen, one in a horror film, and two definitely this year, that just, I was a puddle on the floor, because it was so beautiful in what these characters were doing for each other, really for Sam. So I think that whole arc, beautiful, wouldn't change a thing. I loved it. The final act to me felt a little abrupt in how it was trying to end this story that it introduced. But going back to the beginning, I loved the intro, because initially, before we're even in that hospice center, there's a line on the screen. It says that New York has a constant sound of around 90 decibels, the sound equivalent to a constant scream. And so one, you're immediately scared. You don't know what is going to be happening in this film. And two, it sets up, again, that sound element that New York is loud. And from these monsters that we've known from the first two films, they will kill you if they hear you. Whether you're a child playing with a toy or you step on a piece of glass accidentally, they hear everything. So that, to me, set up the world in a really cool environment. I also love the New York setting. Traveling uptown to a pizza shop, so New York. I had never heard of Patsy's, and there's apparently one right around the corner.
Yeah.
I will be going immediately. I am excited, and there are scenes when people are walking down the streets and the sound just continues to build, and I'm like, oh, this is really good. They know what they're doing, and they target all those things in your mind that would scare you. So I think it's effective. You really care for these characters. And the ending closes the arc, but also leaves it up for the future. Again, we know this is before the other two films, but the information we learn along the way, like there's a whole scene where we learn about what these monsters are doing and why they're doing it. And I didn't necessarily understand that in the movie, but there's a quote that Sarnowski said in an interview. And if you want to learn what that is, go find it out. I don't want to say it in case it spoils something, but it tells you about who they are. And you know that they're just other creatures trying to live on a planet like humans are. So it forms the narrative and really just us in the universe existing in a really interesting way.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. Like, is it perfect? No, I agree. I think the third act has some problems. It is rather abrupt. I think the movie also has a few endings, which I tend to expect from new releases sometimes. This one certainly didn't have the problems that Maxine did in terms of endings. We'll get there. But I also just, like, Joseph Quinn as Eric, where is this extremely kind, good with cats, British lawyer in New York? Where are you? Come to Brooklyn, please. But I really, really cared for the characters. And I also just loved Frodo, Sam's service cat. He was so cute walking on that leash, and the way she would pick him up in a tote bag and how he would run away and come back to her. And I love, mm-hmm. I thought that the shot when Frodo actually finds Eric and leads him to Sam, I thought that was very beautiful. It was like a close-up from a Malick movie. It made me tear up.
Every time an animal in a film has like minutes of screen time, I'm always like, this animal will be seen by millions of people and has more screen time than I ever will.
Yes.
In any sort of film or TV show. But you're right. The cat is so charismatic and quiet, which is a really important characteristic, and always comes back to Sam. And that's really what's so important, even though she leads Eric into this really hellish environment at one point. You end up really loving the cat. You can't hate it. Do I understand it? No, because I think it's a liability in terms of surviving in this quiet environment. But I understand that it's like this sense of home and protection for Sam and Eric once Eric meets it as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Daniel, my cat, would be terrible in this environment because he's so vocal. He screams all the time. So he really would be a liability. But he also doesn't leave my side. So that just means that the end of the world here just wouldn't go well for me. A quick note on Patsy's. I did have to laugh because so they exit the subway in that underwater scene at 59th Street, 59th and Lex, which is where I get off for the office sometimes. And there's a Patsy's literally blocks away.
Oh my God.
It's so close. Oh. It's the one we order from at the office sometimes, which is why I laughed. And I was like, no, just turn, just go a few more blocks. There's a Patsy's right there. But I understand that the one in Harlem had sentimental value for Sam and her connection with her dad. So we always talk about horror movies not having any awards potential. The first one did get a nomination for sound editing. And remember, Emily Blunt won the SAG Award for supporting actress. And the second one had a BAFTA sound nomination. So it's not unheard of for this franchise. But what do you think about day one?
I think in terms of the Academy, it's like they've been there, done that. And I don't necessarily think this has as good of a place. Like we mentioned, it was this new type of film that we hadn't seen before, and I think played into the sound really well. But I think with this being a prequel, and the Academy has an issue with those, let alone the horror genre. So I don't really think it does here. I think Lupita's performance is wonderful, and why the movie works as much as it does is because from those early moments where she's this extremely cynical patient, but hilarious, and then eventually has more of a dramatic performance and sometimes very emotional that she does incredibly well, you buy into it all. Do I think she's going to get a nomination for lead actress? Absolutely not. I'll save my one Oscar for a second because we haven't mentioned it yet, but what do you think about potential?
Yeah, I don't think that this one does, unfortunately, even in sound, just because what I was talking about earlier with Millicent Simmons and her character in the movie, I think having a deaf character in the film and playing off of her experience, that was what made the sound in the movie so unique. And that doesn't really exist here in the same way. So I would say this doesn't have any awards potential, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't, because I also loved Lupita Nyong'o's performance in particular.
So if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
I would give a special juvenile award to Schnitzel the cat for Frodo. I love the cat so much. No, I'm just kidding. If I can do a real one, I would say best actress for Lupita Nyong'o, because she reminded us why she's a star and why she's one of our great working actresses and why she should be in so much more. I think that her performance was really layered, and I'm not going to say she surprised me because she's always excellent, but there was something I think about her and the pain that she was feeling as a character, the cynicism, but also this really, you know, intense, fierce resolve at the end of the world, I thought was really great. And that's why I'd give her my Oscar. What about you?
So I'm going with original score here. The composer, Alexis Gropsos, did an incredible job. One, because it's a prequel. I wasn't, I guess, expecting really grand or this really sweeping sound that really mirror the narrative, but the music goes from horror and dark to really almost operatic and like an old-timey soundtrack that I really loved, that played into the drama and the emotion. So I think it was pitch perfect in all of those moments, guiding us along. And yeah, it was another element that to me made the movie really work alongside Lupita. So I think that would have been a close second for me.
Also, Joseph Quinn, great performance. He's also, I think, a budding star. Can't wait to see him in more, too.
Gladiator 2.
Oh my God, the trailer.
This is his year.
It's coming.
So next up, we'll be talking about Maxine. Description here: in 1980s Hollywood, adult film star and aspiring actress Maxine Minx finally gets her big break. But as a mysterious killer stalks the starlets of Hollywood, a trail of blood threatens to reveal her sinister past. This is directed by Ty West, stars Mia Goth, Kevin Bacon, Halsey, Elizabeth Debicki, Moses Sumney, Bobby Cannavale, and Lily Collins. So I mentioned up top, this is the final film in Ty West's trilogy. How do you think this fits in with the other two, X and Pearl? And maybe how would you rank them, or which do you prefer most?
It's really, really difficult because I am just not a huge fan of Ty West and his films. I think House of the Devil is my favorite of his movies because I think there's something very unnerving about the style of performance, about the music and how it's used. And it just feels like this great throwback, low-budget horror movie. I liked X. I thought that there were parts of it that were a good ode to these kinds of like 70s B-horror movies and look into the porn industry. But I really didn't like the way that it looked at aging. I felt that that was kind of mean-spirited a little bit, and also couldn't really understand what I was trying to say in that regard. With Pearl, that was a classic case, I think, of me not loving origin stories and it being just a little bit overhyped. And it was one of those where I just left and I was like, you know, I wish I liked that more. I found both of those movies really committed to their worlds, like the aesthetics of the time period and the style of filmmaking. I thought that that was at least worth the price of admission to see what Ty West was doing, and more importantly, to see what Mia Goth was doing. So I was really excited for this movie, actually, because I do love the 80s as a time period, just in film, and the music and the fashion is really just fun to be a part of, and the 80s slashers too, and Brian De Palma. So I think I was most excited actually for this one when I saw the trailer, but I was quickly let down and disappointed by it because it just felt like it never added up to anything more than just a list of references. Like, you could just see Ty West thinking, I want to include Buster Keaton, I want to include Cruising, I want to include Chinatown, I have to get in St. Elmo's Fire, and all of these music cues, all of these LA locations. Like, he had to try to get everything in, but that didn't really amount to a movie to me. It was really just like a long list of scenes and references that never fully came together. At the beginning, I was having a good time with it, and then pretty quickly I realized that there was just nothing underneath it for me to really latch on to and to think, oh, this is a great new horror movie and third movie in a trilogy. So overall, I would say I was pretty disappointed by it, but I don't think it's that much worse than Pearl or X. I don't think it's a huge decline, for me at least, because I wasn't as big of a fan of those movies as other people were. And I think all three have similar problems. What did you think?
So talking about the trilogy, I really liked X. I think the ending was really frightening. And the story somewhat mirroring Texas Chainsaw Massacre and what happened to that group of teens. So it modernizing that with, I thought, really inventive editing. That was a fun experience. Pearl, a little bit blander. It's Mia Goth's film again. And we got wonderful gifts from that. I'm a Star just lives on to this day. Do I think it's as exciting of a story? Absolutely not. And I think with Maxine, we have to treat it as a movie that's not a part of a trilogy. That's kind of how disappointing it was to me in terms of it completing this story of her character. She's had three different names. Why is that? Knowing that she played the older woman in X as well with extreme prosthetics, and she was her own character, you know, how does that play in? And now she's seeing visions of that woman again, like when she's on the Universal lot in the Psycho House, another reference. Lots of stairs in this movie too. It's like you're always going up somewhere. That doesn't really lead anywhere. It leads
not
to
a stairway
an empty
to heaven.
Hollow house.
Yeah.
So I think that's where it stops for me, because in that sense, it was a great 80s throwback film. It's a total mood piece. The editing, the costumes, the hairdo, the music, the movie references in the film itself. Like, they work at a video store, and some of them are fake. Like, she's starring in the new Puritan film and sequel that is being directed by Elizabeth Debicki's character. Absolutely loved her here. I loved Mia Goth. But again, it didn't really amount to anything. And what I wanted from this trilogy was this really exciting, fresh conclusion. And they kind of just hint at it early on. And I'm like, is this it?
Yeah.
And then there's this whole other narrative that plays out with the serial killer that doesn't really have anything to do with the previous two films, or that it's a copycat of somebody else that's also killing in this movie. And I'm like, what is this saying about her character or this experience? And in that sense, it was a big letdown. I've also heard of friends going in who have never seen the other two movies, never heard of them, and went in and loved it. And I'm like, I think that's how you have to go in and think about this movie, is that it's on its own. It's not a part of a trilogy, mm-hmm. which is not really what Ty West set out to do. But, you know, even Martin Scorsese is applauding him for having done this trilogy where each film takes place in a different generation and mirrors the movies in that generation. So I think this will have very mixed opinions, and it has. And I think that dampened my expectations going in. And that's why I kind of came out of it feeling okay. And I think that's fine. It's entertaining enough, but it's nothing really that new.
Yeah, I think that's right, though. Like, it is probably viewed best as an individual movie separate from Pearl and X, which is a problem when you're thinking about a trilogy, but it does kind of work to stand alone. And part of the problem with that is it just doesn't go deep enough into any of the ideas. And if you're involving, I think, so many real life experiences and events like the Satanic Panic, like the Night Stalker, you need to approach those in much stronger ways. And we've had plenty of filmmakers who, you know, do revisionist histories or who attach fictional characters to events of the past or historical figures. Look at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think that's an example of a film that does that very well. I know that that also has its detractors. I am not one of them, but I think that this and that film are just night and day. And part of the problem with Maxine for me was also that I don't really think the film cares about her as a character. I feel like this one of all the films gives Mia Goth the least to do, because the film never lets her be vulnerable for 1 second. We'll work our way up in a scene and then it'll cut to the next thing. We never really get that from her as a character. And that's really difficult. And I was much more attached, I think, to the supporting performances in the movie. You have Elizabeth Debicki as Elizabeth Bender, this director who is this very, you know, serious British woman, but she's making these B horror movies. I think that's kind of amazing. And I wanted more from her. I wanted more of Michelle Monaghan as Detective Williams. I really liked her. Whatever Kevin Bacon was doing as this fake Jake Gittes, the Chinatown reference, just really sent me to space. I was like, what are we doing here? But I was entertained by Kevin Bacon and his commitment. I just wish that we didn't use the Chinatown costume.
It's funny you brought up Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because that's all I was thinking during one scene in the movie. Was that the same backlot that they shot on in that movie, or is that a different backlot?
when she's running through.
Yeah.
It looks very
similar.
And
it's all the old timey. And I was like, oh my God, is that the scene with Leo?
So they're different studios. So I don't think so. But they look very similar. Because the scene with Leo and Julia Butters looks very similar to the scene when Maxine is running around.
Yeah.
But it is a very like traditional Western setting. So it might be, I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
I mean, the point to that is that I was so distracted by the setting that I was like, wait, is this that? And I kind of zoned out for a little bit.
Amazing. You didn't miss anything.
But that was funny. And to your point about Mia, similarly to Pearl, where she has this audition and she really overperforms, we get that here and it's so early. It's one of her first scenes. So I think setting her up in that way was just kind of a letdown because, again, yeah, she doesn't have a ton to do. She has some really great scenes where she's up against Buster Keaton, for example. It's funny, but yeah, there's not a ton of variety in what we see from her from there on out. But I do like, again, we had an introductory quote on the screen, and it was, until you're a monster, you won't be seen as a star in Hollywood. And who said that? Of course, Betty Davis. That being our first reference of the movie, I really enjoyed that. It got a chuckle out of me.
Me too.
And from there, obviously, that's setting up her character that we know her as too, of like, she wants to be famous no matter what.
Yeah, the Betty Davis quote was great because then I also started, my mind wandered, and I imagined Betty Davis on Dick Cavett reacting to this movie. Like, if we could blend time periods. Yeah, I mean, the problem, I think, with having the scene of her audition so early is that Ty West decides to never show Maxine really perform again. And it reminded me of a comment I make about the 1937 version of A Star Is Born, which is, if Esther Blodgett is a star, why do I never get to see her act? Like, how am I supposed to believe that this person is a star if I don't get to, I think, experience more of that throughout the film? And I wish we could have seen her act opposite Lily Collins or really get into this movie. But it feels like her role as an actress is really just to be late to meetings at the lot, to run around, and to get told by Elizabeth Debicki that she's the next best thing, but they could find another person in 2 minutes. So it's just kind of confusing because I just wanted to see more of that star power and her want to be a part of the industry and bringing her trauma into that in a way that was separate from just being distracted, in a way that was connected, I think, to that first audition scene, because it's a great way to open the movie. From that scene, thought, oh, I'm going to like this. This is going to be really good. And then it just, I don't know, the energy just faded the more it stretched on.
Alternate ending, we see her in some really horrific scene in this movie. I mean, we get a reference in our final scene of the actual film, but I think that would have been more exciting than what we do, where it's something flashed on the screen with the credits rolling. That felt pretty bland to me.
Yeah. I also just laughed so hard because the cast of her severed head looked so much like Diane Keaton in The Godfather to me. Like, the face is the same. And I just thought, what is going on here? That does not look like Mia Goth. That is a young Diane Keaton. But I did also, I love the music. I will say that. It had some really good songs. Mm-hmm. The soundtrack was good. I wish that the score felt a bit more 80s, Reznor Ross, synth poppy. But, I mean, any movie that has even 30 seconds of Shell Shock by New Order, you have my attention. So that was fun. But yeah, some good needle drops throughout. Like you said at the top, too, love the costumes, the hair and makeup, the production design. I think all of those elements were really fun and aided in creating this beautiful, flashy 80s LA aesthetic.
Yeah. So how do you feel about awards potential?
I would say this movie does not have any awards potential, but I'm happy with how it's doing at the box office. Despite not loving this trilogy, I do think it's really cool that three horror movies set in completely different time periods that have all been successful at the box office. people are going to see these movies and really like them. So I think that's something to be excited about, even if they're not always my cup of tea.
Yeah, I don't think there are any awards coming this way. Maybe some horror festivals or potentially smaller critics' prizes for someone like Mia Goth. But yeah, I think it's a summer movie. Go have fun, enjoy it, be entertained. I think that's it. And that's okay too, because we need those. I think A24 has done a great job, and there are a lot of people that will see anything that they produce and develop.
So if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
It would be for Mia Goth, despite what we said about her arc in the film. But I think she's a great actress. She really knows how to heighten her acting and the character in these sorts of environments. And I really enjoy that. She seemed so confident, but also fun at times, and just really brave. And I love seeing that in a performance, especially in a horror film where maybe characters aren't supposed to be that way. It's kind of like a breath of fresh air. So mine would be for her. What would your Oscar be?
Mine would be for Marianne Seo for costume design. I loved the costumes in the movie, and I thought that they were really playful and bright and also a fun commentary on 80s horror films. I saw a lot of references to De Palma movies, like I mentioned. You have the Buster Keaton reference, which, you know, I didn't love that moment in the movie, but the costume I did enjoy. And I think that the way that, again, it's she played with these Hollywood references and the time period, that was really fun. So I would say costume design. Okay, on to our last movie, the long-awaited Long Legs. Description here: in pursuit of a serial killer, an FBI agent uncovers a series of occult clues that she must solve to end his terrifying killing spree. This was directed by Osgood Perkins and stars Micah Monroe, Nicolas Cage, Alicia Witt, Kiernan Shipka, and more. What did you think of Long Legs? I know this was one of your most anticipated movies of the year. And we ended up seeing it together at an early screening last week, which was very fun. But yeah, what did you think of it?
We talked about this on our 2024 release episode too, and we were both excited for it then. It's had so much hype, and I think that's my problem with movies like that. And I'm glad I saw it early just to get ahead of some of that. But I'm curious if I hadn't seen it until after the actual release, aka today, if we would have had other reviews saying that it wasn't the scariest movie in the past decade, the best movie since The Silence of the Lambs. You know, it sets up this setting, this mood, this terror in your mind of when you were watching those, and specifically the scariest parts of those movies. And the scene in the basement when Clarice is down there trying to rescue that woman, and it's pitch black and you can't see a thing, like your heart is racing. And I didn't have any of that during this movie. So I was a little disappointed. What Perkins really gets at is atmospheric dread and just constantly feeling like something isn't right. And whether it's like the incandescent lights that seem oddly bright inside or this orange haze outside when she's out alone at night, like all of those things play into this being a decent horror film. But I think the story, its development, having so many puzzles, like that is what this campaign has been. It's clues that you need to decode that turn into more clues or references to Satan or these demonic creatures that you still don't know what they mean. Or it's to a song, like a lyric from a song, and then you listen to the song and it's like, okay, now what? You know, it keeps leading you down this path. And then at some point in the movie, it's like, bam, it's over. And I was like, what just happened? So my experience was kind of a letdown. It's not the worst movie I've ever seen or anything, but I would like for people to go in a little bit more level-headed in this and know that it's not a new type of horror. But I think it is really a movie that fits into Perkins' filmography perfectly. I've seen The Black Coat's Daughter, and I really wasn't a fan of that one either, but it's really for the same reasons. Have you seen any of his other movies? And how do those relate to what you thought about Long Legs?
So I haven't seen The Black Coat's Daughter. I have seen Gretel and Hansel, and I do like that one. So for me with Long Legs, I do agree. I think that if I could give anyone any advice, if you haven't seen the movie yet and you're listening to this show, definitely temper your expectations. You know, don't read the tweets that are saying this movie was forged in hell by Satan, or that you're going to maybe come out a different person, or it's going to feel like you've gone to hell and back. Kind of limit that a little bit. I loved the first two acts of this movie. You know, I love a slow burn more than anything, and I was just living in that atmospheric dread, in the way that the camera was capturing these characters and these images. And then we get to the third act, which I'll explain, I think, why I felt a little bit let down by that. And I think standards for horror movies have diminished significantly in recent years. I don't really like the new Scream movies. The David Gordon Green, whatever's going on there, like, please, I can't do it. I just wanted something that was good and that actually scared me. And after watching this, I can say, you know, initially when I left the theater, I thought, I don't really know how I feel about what I saw. Like, that wasn't that scary. And then I had nightmares on and off for a week, just about different images from the movie. Like a doll or a crucifix or a family annihilator, like all of these different things, like images and themes in the movie just kept creeping up in my dreams. So it has had a really strong hold on me. And I think that for me, it's because it is stronger than the horror movies we've gotten in recent years. I can't really think of another one that has been quite as strong in atmosphere, right? In creating an experience that does make you feel dread. I was thinking about this, and I wrote this in my Letterboxd review. I called my mom after I saw it, like after you and I went in different directions. I called my mom and she was asking me about it, and I told her, and I'm sorry to anyone listening who doesn't believe in ghosts, I'm gonna get a little kooky here. I told her that the feeling that I had watching this was very similar to the feeling I've had when I've been in rooms that are haunted or areas that have a really negative history, which is you get this like really tight feeling in your chest that's telling you you need to leave. Like you shouldn't be here. There's something else here that isn't right. And there were specific scenes in this movie that made me feel that way. So I know I told people not to get like too scared or anything, but that's the best thing I can say about it, is that it did make me feel that in particular ways. You might be able to guess which scenes I'm talking about. I don't want to give really a lot away, but I also want to say, please do not go into this movie expecting Silence of the Lambs. There are very clear touches that will remind you of the Silence of the Lambs. One that I thought that I was really glad that you pointed out in your review was that shot where we see Lee Harker, the Micah Monroe character, and she's surrounded by men in the FBI. It's a much less effective shot compared to what Jonathan Demme does in The Silence of the Lambs, but there are little things like that that make you think of that movie, basements, women in the FBI, the 90s, right? There's so many different moments, a serial killer she's hunting. But that film is just so, so different and so brilliant in what it does that it does Long Legs a disservice to compare it to The Silence of the Lambs. It's like going to a new movie and comparing it to The Godfather. It's just your best just not to do it, as similar as it might seem on the surface.
And I appreciate all the references, but to me, that's what they are. It's Harker's name drawing back to Jonathan Harker from Dracula. It's elements of Dr. Caligari in here. It's elements of these movies, but it's not the movie or better. Because it's also this really great amalgamation of so many different horror subgenres. There's not a single one that you can pinpoint. It's all of them. And I think that's another part to really applaud of Perkins's direction and what he did with the script, is that he made this all come together in a way that, you know, to me, it didn't end up having this grand effect, but he made a really convincing narrative that does work to an extent, or in scenes makes you feel like, you said, you know, you have a tight chest. It really makes your skin crawl. And I think that's what it is. It's that parts of the film really worked, other parts didn't. And overall, I just wanted to be scared more. That's kind of the bottom line. He has two other films being produced by Neon, who also did this. So they really believe in him. His next one is called The Monkey, which is a Stephen King adaptation. That one looks really exciting. So I think he's on his way. He's developing his craft and his vision and the slow burn, his slow camera. All of that is in all of the films that he's made so far. So I think he's getting there. And I'm excited still to see what comes next. Nicolas Cage as Long Legs. It's funny, they released a trailer today as of recording. It's like the final bit of Micah Monroe, the first time she saw Nicolas Cage dressed up in his character, and her heartbeat was 170 BPM. And I think his look is really what stuck with me the most. A week out from my viewing, it's just his totally unsettling appearance, this really porcelain-like skin, his powdered face, his red lips, his feminine voice that you still hear the Nicolas Cage in. It is really hair-raising in every way. And he has multiple scenes that just really put me on edge, had my jaw on the floor. And I won't spoil any of those lines, but it leaves you in a really creepy way. Creepy, funny way, kind of, but...
Mm-hmm. It is kind of funny. I agree.
He just totally went there. He's at an 11 out of 10, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what you want from a perfect horror performance. So he absolutely succeeded at this film, and I think people will love him as much as we did.
It's funny, though, because I think he didn't scare me as much as some of the other images in the film that I think were just very still. Like the one crime scene she visits where we just see bodies underneath a duvet, like raised, and that really, that one stayed with me. I hated that. And the religious imagery. So being raised Catholic, going to Catholic schools, anything with demons or the devil or like Catholic adjacent horror themes really scare me. Like that is one of my favorite horror genres. Like if you are dealing in any way with the occult and Satan, like I am locked in. So if you combine that then with a crime story of the FBI and these clues, I am all about that in terms of theme and then subgenre of horror. I also want to talk about the opening. I know we're kind of going in a bunch of different directions with this, but the way that the film starts where the camera is in the car and it feels like someone is watching this house. It's like cloaked in snow. Everything is bright white. It's a tight claustrophobic aspect ratio. It's like you're looking at it through a viewfinder. We see that terrifying scene with the little girl and how birthdays are involved and all these little details that'll come back into play later on. And as we see the first flash of Long Legs, the aspect ratio changes, starts to expand and widen. I thought that that was really beautiful and a very terrifying and creative way to open this movie. And I think I wish that the rest of the film felt like that or reached those highs. I think it does in some places, but in others, I think what you brought up, so I want to ask you, is this just a replica of references or does it transcend that and become its own thing? I think that's the line, right? Like Hereditary is a Rosemary's Baby remake, but like that movie for you transcends and becomes a new type of horror movie. Did Long Legs do that effectively in this genre with films like Carrie and Zodiac and Seven and Silence of the Lambs?
I think it's a mix. You know, it's not any of those classics. It's not a classic to me. But in some way, it still feels like its own thing, even though I think it is made up of all of those smaller references, because I don't think we've seen this style of film from anybody before, even if while we're mentioning it, we're talking about all these other movies along with it. So I think it's somewhere in the middle. And that's why I say, like, he's on his way. And I hope that, you know, a movie from now, two movies from now, it's like, oh my God, this movie is a 5-star classic, exactly how I felt about Hereditary. Or even to this day, I find new things in that movie. And I think for some people, it will be that, but it wasn't for me.
I mean, I think that's fair. I think that, like, for me, I left feeling a little bit lower on it. And the low point for me is just something that bothers me in any movie when a director decides to do it. I call it the Shyamalan special, which is to give you a nice exposition dump via a character that seemingly in that moment exists to deliver exposition. And that happens here. And when it does, I couldn't help but feel a little bit disappointed, because I just wanted him to trust us as the audience a bit more to get there, because we have so many of these clues. Like you were saying, there's so many clues throughout, and Harker has this special connection somehow, right, to being able to really easily translate these clues. And I think the ending is a bit predictable, not in execution, but in where it goes. I did expect that. I think some of it is because I watch so much horror, and specifically the reference that I think he's going for with a lot of the ending. But yeah, having it, I think, a bit neatly tied up in that section. And I, again, wrote this in my Letterboxd review. It reminded me of like a satanic or witchy fairy tale. Specifically, what it reminded me of was in the movie The Witches, the Nicholas Rogue version. So the scariest part to me in that entire movie that I grew up loving as a kid, and what always stuck with me, were these scenes where Luke, the little boy, his grandmother would tell him these fairy tales, essentially, about witches, but they were real, of course. And she would tell him a story about a girl who was trapped in a painting, and then she ended up growing up old in the painting. And the way that those stories were told were so scary and stuck with me as a young viewer and still stick with me today. And I think that the way that that monologue, which is just exposition here in Long Legs, and it is a big reveal, the way that it's delivered is really striking. And I think it works in a very similar way to the way that those fairy tales work. I think I just wish it was maybe unveiled in a different way. I don't know. I need to see it again and just see how I feel now that I know what's coming, how I feel about that reveal, so to speak.
I've debated if I want to see this movie again or not. I've been thinking about it all week, but also because of writing a review about it and trying to like make sure I remember everything. So I've been kind of driving myself crazy in that way. But it would also be fun to see what general audiences feel about it and what they react to in the film. And then also, yes, to see if I feel the same way, because I came out of it somewhat disappointed and then it only fell from there. And I'm curious if a second viewing would change if I were to pick up on other things along the way.
Yeah, that's exactly where I am right now. Like there are certain, I think it's so effective as a mood piece and what it does with tone and creating this feeling of dread and extreme unease. I'm going in this weekend and seeing it with people who haven't seen it. So I'm excited about that too, just to see the reactions.
Yeah. What do you think about Oscar potential?
Well, not so much Oscars, but I think like indie spirit or critics, like there's some potential in certain categories. I can absolutely see a critics group giving a supporting actor prize to Nicolas Cage. Like it just does seem like one of those weird wins that could happen. I mean, it should be considered for a number of things, I think. Cinematography, mainly score, a lot of the technical components, I think, should be recognized, but I don't think it will get all the way to industry prizes. It is a horror movie after all.
You know, we've mentioned on the pod some like fun New York Film Critics Circle acting prizes recently, and this would be one to maybe happen. And I think maybe it still could, but I agree with you that it's the independent award bodies that could award Nicolas Cage, I think he has the most potential. I love the cinematography. I love the sound. There's a lot of editing. So all of those elements, they play into the film really well. And that's really important for a horror movie too, to make sure all of the elements are working in its favor.
I think so too. So if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
My Oscar goes to Andres Arochi, who is the cinematographer for the film. The different aspect ratios, the lighting, the framing of the characters, just always making you feel like they're exposed and susceptible to either long legs or something in their environment, is such a commendable thing that this film does constantly. I love how the aspect ratio changes throughout the time periods too, and it gives it this old-timey feel. And yeah, that was my favorite part, was just the mood and the vibe that this movie exuded. So yeah, I would give it to him. What would your Oscar be?
I'm in the exact same boat. Andres Arochi for cinematography, for all of the reasons that you said. I think that the look of the movie in recreating the 70s and the 90s, and I also just think the way that he frames particular rooms and objects is pretty terrifying. My runner-up would actually be for sound. I think that the sound work in the film is incredible. So I would say cinematography or sound. And if you really like Long Legs, or if you want more information on the movie after you see it, like if you want a spoiler-filled deep dive, listen to this podcast called The Boo Crew. They interviewed Oz Perkins, and he goes into some really fun details about making the movie, about Nicolas Cage showing up to set, how they only had a limited amount of time to shoot with him. They had a box of teeth and fingernails that he talks about in detail that I thought was really fun. So listen to that. We can link it in the description if you want a deep dive after you've seen the movie.
Ooh, I'm definitely going to do that. Yeah, that sounds great. So that was our episode on three horror films from the summer: A Quiet Place Day One, Maxine, and Long Legs. They're all currently in theaters. Go see them. Get out of the summer heat and enjoy the cool AC while you scream your heart out, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully you find these movies scary. The movie we're talking about next week might be scarier even than some of these. We will be talking about The Notebook on our Patreon series, Oscar Wilde After Dark. This will be your first time watching The Notebook. We always cover Rachel McAdams movies. It just worked out that way on Patreon, and this movie celebrating its 20th anniversary. So we will be talking all about that, the chokehold that it had on my friends growing up, and more.
Everyone but me, since I didn't see
everyone but you, yeah.
But I am excited to watch it. I am doing that very soon. Our full episode will be released on Patreon at patreon.com/OscarWilde, and we will have a snippet on the main feed. So get ready for that. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at OscarWildePod. Again, bonus content on our Patreon.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.